On the program today, a little bit of retail, the economics of climate change, and tax cuts 2.0. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 21st day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The World Economic Forum in Davos is, well, it is what it is, right? Lots of very important people talking about very important things with very debatable actual results. So that's important context. But day one this year, today, did put a special focus on climate change. And if you've been keeping score the past number of months, a lot of companies are actually out ahead of all the VIPs. The CEO of Starbucks said today the coffee company would, and this is a quote, give more than we take from the planet. Microsoft promised, as we have reported yesterday, that it's going to recapture all the CO2 it's ever emitted. JetBlue says it's going to go carbon neutral, offsetting what its planes pump into the air. The investment firm BlackRock, as we reported, the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England are all talking climate change now. So, Marketplace's Nova Sappho gets us going with why business and finance are increasingly going various shades of green.
Business is having an environmental moment, and Willy Zemler has noticed.
In the last few months, it has taken off more.
Zemler tracks the economics of climate change at the New School. He says one reason for that acceleration is that disasters are in the news.
And the people have now realized that something has to be done.
A recent survey found that 3 in 4 Americans are now worried about climate change. That's an all-time high, says Anthony Leiserwitz of Yale, who co-published the results.
Many companies are scrambling to try to respond to this shift in the political, social, and cultural climate of climate change.
And the financial risks it poses. Starbucks has promised to go what it calls resource positive, regenerating more natural resources, like drinking water, than it uses up. Leiserwitz says companies are responding to pressure from within, too. Employees want to work where climate change is taken seriously.
These kinds of attributes become really, really important in trying to attract top-shelf talent.
But what are companies actually promising with terms like carbon negative, carbon neutral, sustainable? Edward Maybach, who studies climate change communication at George Mason University, says that's a good question.
Part of the problem with sort of the whole greening of the corporate sector has been the fact that the terms have been very vague.
Which, Maybach says, can make consumers skeptical. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
As President Trump's lawyers began his defense in the Senate today, the president himself has been at the aforementioned World Economic Forum talking not climate change, but his record on this economy, which he says has juiced the stock market and created a windfall for American workers, especially in the blue-collar economy. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains, labor market definitions, they matter.
President Trump's speech to the crowd at Davos in some ways mirrors his campaign speeches, highlighting a portion of the economy that includes some of his strongest supporters.
Celebrating the dignity of work is a fundamental pillar of our agenda. This is a blue-collar boom.
Is it, though? If blue-collar means manufacturing, not so much. Anthony Carnevale is director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown.
In 1980, we had 30% of the jobs in the American economy were on the factory floor, and that's now dropped to 9%.
And the recent trade war hasn't helped things. The Federal Reserve said the manufacturing sector was actually in a minor recession in 2019. But the president is right. The economy has been growing.
What he's really talking about is expansion in the service economy below the college level, not really expansion in manufacturing or production work.
A generous definition of a blue-collar worker, but inclusive of a lot of the country's recent job growth. Kate Bond is director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Where we're seeing the most growth continues to be in education, in healthcare, and in leisure and hospitality, which has jobs across the income spectrum.
And even though it took almost a decade of economic recovery, low-wage workers are starting to see some raises. Adam Michel is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation.
The people earning about $12 an hour have seen wage growth of about 7% over the last year, which is more than double the economy-wide average.
Giving President Trump something to brag about at Davos. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Red on the major indices this Tuesday. Could be coronavirus, could be impeachment. Who really knows? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those hoping 2020 would bring a respite from news of retail store closings? Wait till next year, I guess. Papyrus is said to be closing all of its U.S. locations. Same with Bose, the audio equipment company. Macy's, Pier 1, JCPenney, they are all closing stores as well. Which brings us to kind of a fundamental question about American retail. Are there just too many stores? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
There's a concept in retail that gets thrown around a lot, that the U.S. is overstored. Maybe you've heard something like this on other business news programs.
The nation is overstored.
America is overstored, needs to shrink its retail space.
There are so many stores, we got to cut back the number.
They're talking about the amount of retail square footage per person.
The United States has way more than any other developed economy.
Joel Rampolt is a managing director at Alex Partners.
And so the idea of being overstored is, how can that be healthy when we have so many stores chasing a relatively small number of customers?
Not enough customers to justify spending money on wages, rent, heat, electricity, all the costs of running a store. Mark Cohen at Columbia Business School says the problem goes back a few decades, that in the U.S., stores and malls were built based on how much land was available.
The developers followed the view that if they built it, the customers would come.
Then the recession hit, and they stopped coming. And then more people started shopping online. Not everyone agrees with this idea that the U.S. has too many stores. While many chains are closing stores, others are opening them. Joel Rampolt at Alex Partners says the term overstored can become an excuse for retailers that can't figure out how to make stores attractive to potential customers. He says what retailers should be asking is,
how can we be better? How can we be different? How can we give the shopper something that she or he can't get anywhere else?
Like an experience or an environment that you can't get with just a click. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Here's a real estate story that's actually kind of retail adjacent. It's a store you can see in skylines all over the country. Cities are building more apartments, and those apartment buildings are getting taller. Back in the 90s, nearly all new apartment buildings topped out at about four stories. Today, low-rise buildings make up less than half of new construction, and mid- and high-rise buildings have pretty much overtaken the traditional garden-style apartment. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into why.
First floor.
In the sleek lobby of a new apartment building in Baltimore, there's modern art on the walls and cushy benches for lounging. Ayanna Lugo is right at home in the 18-story tower.
I'm from Manhattan. I grew up in a high rise. I lived on the 31st floor. You know, I gotta be downtown. I'm a downtown girl.
Lugo is 44 and used to work for a medical cannabis company. She's taking time off to care for her parents. When we met, she was on her way out to run some errands with her little dog, Goliath.
There's a supermarket right up the street. We're going to stop by the liquor store. There's one of those over there, too. And then we're going to get some peanuts from the peanut nut place or something up there. We're just going to do a big loop.
Being able to do that is one big reason for the high-rise boom. More people want to walk to the stuff they need. But there's only so much land surrounding clusters of restaurants, grocery stores, parks, and shops.
And so the way that you squeeze more people into an urban core is by stacking them on top of one another vertically.
Jenny Schutz researches housing and land policy at the Brookings Institution. She says the growing cost of land is another factor. Developers need to build more units to make a profit. Cities like New York and San Francisco that can't grow out have been growing up for a long time.
But we're definitely seeing in markets like Denver and Houston and Nashville, places where people normally would have expected to have a little more space and spread out, but people are really demanding these neighborhood amenities, and so that's driving the type of development we see.
Even in suburbs, new developments are mimicking the feel of an urban center, with apartments built on top of retail shops in 8 to 10-story buildings. Yet with all these new apartments, rents are still rising. And Doug Ressler with Yardi Matrix says that's because they're all pretty much full.
basically, it's the economics of supply and demand. There's more demand than there is supply.
We can thank the housing crisis for that. Caitlin Walter is with the National Multifamily Housing Council, which represents landlords and developers. She says construction nearly ground to a halt and is still catching up.
You're looking at 10 years where we weren't building enough. And so, unfortunately, while we are building it, it's not really making a dent in the affordability problems so far in most places.
And in some of the most expensive cities, many local leaders and homeowners are fighting against taller buildings.
In most of these places that have the worst affordability problems, like California, they have the most regulations and it takes the longest to actually build new units.
To maximize profits, developers are also catering to professionals who can afford higher rents. About 80% of new construction is in the luxury market. At Ayanna Lugo's building in Baltimore, a two-bedroom goes for up to $2,500 in a city where the median rent for that size is about $1,200. But there's a health club and private balconies, a rooftop terrace with a pool and club room.
There's, I think, like shuffleboard, there's pool table, there's like a little movie theater. It's really cool up there. It's beautiful.
And fortunately for Goliath, they allow pets. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
To the list of industries counting on artificial intelligence for a business edge, we can now add Hollywood. Warner Brothers has announced it's using an AI-driven system to help executives decide where to put the studio's money. Tatiana Siegel is the executive film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me how this would work, would you?
Well, you know, maybe I should actually start with the dirty little secret, which is that every studio relies upon some AI-backed tool or another. Huh. So the Warner Brothers deal isn't that unique. It's just that this might be the first one that was publicly announced. But Netflix, for example, they are rolling up at these festivals with their laptops. And they're running their algorithms to see if a particular movie will appeal to their vast global audience. And if so, with whom and where exactly it'll appeal and at what value.
Okay, so on the theory that algorithms are written by humans, whether it's Warner Brothers or Netflix's or whatever's, what are some of the inputs? What are the metrics?
Well, you have to think that every one of these movies, be it a Netflix movie or a Warner Brothers movie, gets released in, you know, it can be 190 territories. Mm-hmm, so how will it play there? How much value does that star have? And I think that it helps the studios make decisions, not whether or not to greenlight the movie entirely, but like how much money to put into the release in Indonesia or wherever. Right. Like, it'll inform decision making as opposed to dictate it.
Fair enough. Now, are they making better decisions?
Well, I think that will be borne out in the coming years. But, you know, sometimes you look at some of the decisions that are made and think, how could it get worse? I'll kind of give you a perfect example, just because I'm heading to Sundance next week. But every year at Sundance, there's at least one or two movies where it plays through the roof at the festival, and all of a sudden, I'll call it high altitude madness, but every studio is bidding, and there's a bidding war, and every year, those same movies that are like the highest price tags typically fail at the theatrical setting. So I would say in that case, it could probably make some real, you know, good choices.
Sure, business sense. And look, I get that there are millions of dollars on the line here, and depending on the studio and the movie, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. But there is a part of this that is challenging, I think, because what we're talking about here is art, right? And evaluating really subjective things like how an actor or a set or a movie is going to hit somebody in their gut, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that's why there was sort of this hysterical reaction to my story. But it cannot make creative decisions, at least as AI is currently functioning. Yeah. So you still will have to have human beings who are creative and have guts make the decisions, but they will be armed with better information when they're making decisions.
Tatiana Siegel, she's the executive film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
In this case, there's so many arguments missing.
Not, interestingly enough, an impeachment story. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 152 points today, about a half percent, ended at 29,196. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ shed 18 points, about a tenth percent, 93.70. The S&P 500 down 8, two-tenths percent, 33.20 there. Casino operator Las Vegas Sands drifted down 5.4% today. The company has big interests in China, where coronavirus, as I mentioned earlier, is causing a little bit of concern. Same story with Wynn Resorts, down 6.1% today. Oilfield services provider Halliburton retreated 0.7% despite better-than-expected fourth-quarter earnings. And revenue rival Schlumberger, down 3.7% today. Baker Hughes, also down 3.7%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin went with his boss to Davos today. And speaking to the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Mnuchin mentioned a bit about the Trump administration's 2020 economic agenda.
We are working on what we call Tax 2.0, and that is something we'll be rolling out this year, which will be additional middle-income tax cuts.
No details just yet from the Treasury Secretary, but when he was asked about the revenue impact of more tax cuts, Mnuchin pointed to the revenue impact of Tax 1.0. That, of course, would be the GOP's 2017 tax cut bill.
I'll stick with my projections that the tax deal will pay for itself.
That is an argument you heard a lot from Republicans in the lead up to the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and since. Here is the president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, back last July.
I would argue strongly that the corporate tax cut has already been paid for and that roughly two-thirds of the overall tax cut has been paid for.
Not long after Kudlow said that last summer, we decided it was time to do an explainer on what exactly paid for means. And given that Secretary Mnuchin doubled down today, we decided a paid for revisit is in order.
So the thing about paid for is that you've taken a verb pay and you've gotten rid of all of the arguments.
She's a linguist, so bear with me here, Jessica Rett from UCLA.
So we're used to it in a sentence like, Kai paid Jessica $10 for the beer.
Kind of a lot for a beer, Professor Rett, but I'm with you so far.
So when you say, Kai paid Jessica $10 for the beer, you know exactly how much and who was doing the paying and who was receiving the paying.
That's the argument part.
But if I just say the beer was paid for, you just interpret the sentence as meaning, okay, well, the beer was the thing that was paid for, and I'm just going to have to assume that someone paid someone some amount.
So back to that thing that Larry Kudlow said.
I would argue strongly that the corporate tax cut has already been paid for and that roughly two-thirds of the overall tax cut has been paid for.
In this case, because there's so many arguments missing, you're not giving me any information about who's paying for what. We tend to interpret it as meaning something like it's self-funded.
So are these tax cuts being paid for like somebody's paying for a beer?
These tax cuts are not being, I'm afraid to use the words now after this linguist, but they're not being paid for.
Howard Gleckman is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center in Washington.
There's simply no evidence that the tax cut paid for itself or even paid for two-thirds of itself.
All right, noted, but hang on.
The broader question is, who pays for tax cuts?
The Tax Policy Center figures 65% of Americans got a tax cut in 2018.
So like any tax bills, there were provisions that lowered taxes and there were provisions that raised taxes. Look at the net effect of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. What you find is that it reduced taxes by about $1.5 trillion. That's what you have to pay for.
$1.5 trillion. That's what someone has to pay the government for the tax cut.
The only way you're going to, if you will, pay for this bill is either through economic growth that the bill is going to produce, which hasn't happened, or through borrowing. And if you borrow the money, you eventually have to pay it back. And the people who are going to pay it back are going to be future generations who are going to pay higher taxes or receive fewer government benefits. That's all there is.
Listen, there is still a lot we don't know about the long-term impact of this tax law, but there is some historical context that's helpful here.
You know, we've been to this movie before.
Ronald Reagan cut taxes in 1981. George W. Bush cut taxes in 2001.
And every time, the proponents of those tax cuts argued that they would pay for themselves. And every time, the deficit went up after the tax cuts were enacted, and in fact, went up a lot.
So the next time you hear something like this...
This will pay for itself.
The corporate tax cut has already been paid for.
Eventually, actually, it does pay for itself.
Come on back to Marketplace.org. Play this explainer again. Nova talked a little bit about climate change up at the beginning of the program, how it seems, anyway, to be getting some corporate traction. But there are bigger actors in the climate change economy than just companies. What countries do is a huge global warming input. China, as it happens, uses almost as much coal as the rest of the world put together. Yes, China's also doing a lot in solar and wind, but right now Beijing is reopening coal mines to generate more electricity. The BBC's China correspondent Robin Brandt reports now from Inner Mongolia.
Through the gate, out to where the goats and chickens are. It's minus 15 here, and the snow on the ground isn't going anywhere. Li has lived and farmed on the old frontier in China's north for all of her 54 years. In the depths of winter, staying warm is her number one priority. All she's known is coal, but the pile she is shoveling by the chicken coop has depleted, and the old green coal stove has been moved outside. It's rusting.
I put the wood or the old corn cobs inside here and the coal here, and the heat comes from here.
Life changed a few months ago when Li's house got gas. No more coal or dried corn cobs to heat her home. She is one of millions that China is moving to what it hopes is a greener life.
I'm going to ask her to show you how to turn it on. Oh, OK. Oh, you don't know?
There are vast reserves of coal under our feet in this part of China, and it's a nation struggling to wean itself off of a decades-long addiction.
If they don't give us the subsidy, we will burn our coal to use for heating again. Just forget it. Gas is just too expensive. We are old. How can we afford gas?
China's challenge is encapsulated by that white box on the wall in the corner of the kitchen inside there. How does this country wean itself off of a resource that certainly here is still so plentiful? Coal is cheap, it's reliable, and this is crucial, there are still plenty of Chinese jobs involved in the industry. Around half the coal that's burned across the world in a year is burned here in China. At this facility in Inner Mongolia, coal from dozens of mines is dumped, processed, and then shipped off. I was told that business used to be better here. China has succeeded in cutting back on coal, but things are changing. The country is now expanding its coal mining capacity. It's reversed the trend of recent years, and it's started to increase construction of coal-fired power stations. It's coal that powered China from communist revolution to consumerism. But economic growth here is now slowing, so the government's trying to cushion the impact and protect millions of jobs. It's spending, or rather building, on new apartments, new railway lines, new metro networks. And that means falling back on coal. Professor Bo Chenglin is an academic and advisor to China's National Energy Commission.
Over the last year, there has been a substantial increase in energy demand as well as electricity demand. And renewables are quite small at this moment.
A decade ago, coal accounted for 72% of China's energy mix. That's now down to 58%. But overall, the country's CO2 emissions from fossil fuels are still going up. And that means China's expected to be responsible for effectively all the increase in global CO2 emissions in 2019.
The BBC's Robin Brandt for us there in northern China. This final note on the way out today, a quick corporate story and a vocabulary lesson all rolled into one. Boeing said today it is going to start the process of ungrounding the 737 MAX in mid-2020. Two things about that. Number one, ungrounding is not actually a word. I'll fight you on that. Number two, mid-2020 is kind of vague, no? June? September? I promise you airlines want to know. Boeing's investors, not vague at all. BA shares closed off 3.33% today. Okay, we're done. Dow Industrials off 152 points today, about a half percent. NASDAQ off 18 points, a tenth percent. S&P 500 down 8, that is 0.2%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.